content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading from The Atlantic magazine. First today, An Ode to My Thesaurus by James Parker. Truly an essential, indispensable, necessitous volume. They've got you all wrong. They think you're a trick, a cheat sheet for fancy words, a way of counterfeiting cleverness. And Americans are fatally awed by cleverness. This acclaimed young author slash tweeter slash whatever is always whip smart. That drunk guy is always shouting, "Think you're smarter than me, huh?" Or they'll treat you as a mere lexical resource, a vocabulary expander, a thigh master for the out-of-condition prose. I mean, we've all done it. Reached for you, that is, when the words arriving in our forebrain from the charred and private little glossary that we keep in our back brain seem insufficient. Don't say, in a shitty mood. Say, capricious. But that's not how or when to use you. That's not who you are. You, my friend, are a vision. You're a shamanic trip into the essence of words, a shimmering, unfolding, occasionally scarifying, million-petaled experience, a miraculous nest of emergent relationships. And the writer who abuses your nature, who exploits your abundance, will pay. He will pick the wrong word, and he won't sound clever at all. He'll sound like an ass. He'll sound like a silly billy, a twerp, a stooge. A thesaurus, here it comes, is for increasing one's aliveness to words. Nothing more and nothing less. By going into the buzzing and jostling hive of words around a word, we get a purer sense of the word itself, its coloration, its interior, its traces of meaning. I looked up the verb excite just now and found the word in its effective, touch or move, and mechanical, electrify, galvanize, aspects, which gets at who we are as humans, doesn't it? Feelings and circuitry. Lewis Carroll made up chortle, and you absorbed it, placing it snugly between chuckle, benign and big-bellied, and cackle, witchy and weird. Ken Dodd, the great English comedian, made up tatifilarious. Now, he told an interviewer as an old man, now is reality, and it's wonderful. By Jove, it's tatifilarious. You have not as yet absorbed that. I'd floated in there somewhere between bittersweet and custard pie. As for you, blessed Mr. Roget, they say you had OCD. Of course you did. You were hooked, hung up, haunted by the hidden life of words, their selves, their stories, as told by the words they are closest to. You gave us a great gift. May you rest eternally among your synonyms. Now, America's Corporate Tragedy by Caitlin Flanagan. I was a child soldier in the California grape strikes. My labors conducted outside the Shattuck Avenue Co-op in Berkeley. There I was, maybe 7 or 8 years old, shaking a Folgers coffee can full of coins at a United Farm Workers table where my mother was garrisoned 2 to 3 afternoons a week. I did most of my work alongside her, but several times an hour I would do what child soldiers have always done, served in a capacity that only a very small person could. I'd go out in the parking lot and slip between cars to make sure no one was getting away without donating some coins or signing a petition. I'd pop up next to a driver's side window and give the can an aggressive rattle. I wasn't Jimmy Hoffa, but I wasn't playing any games either. My parents were old-school leftists, born in the 1920s and children during the Great Depression. They would never, ever cross a picket line, fail to participate in a boycott, lose sight of strikers' need for money when they weren't getting paychecks. My parents would never suggest that poverty was caused by a lack of intelligence or effort. We were not a religious family, to say the least, but I had a catechism. One worker is powerless. many workers can bring a company to its knees. What I'm describing, of course, is a lost world, glimpsed only through history books or the memories of old people. It was a world already in the midst of death, even as I was pumping fresh second-grade life into it. The great labor strikes of the late 19th and early 20th centuries of steel workers, textile workers, railroad workers, coal miners were in the past. Union membership peaked at 35% of the U.S. workforce in 1954. By the grape strike in 1965, it was already down to 28%. A decade and a half later, the former president of the Screen Actors Guild, Ronald Reagan, put collective bargaining in the dustbin of history by ordering striking air traffic controllers back to work. And when they didn't go, he fired them. Today, only 10% of workers have union protections. Unions faltered for many reasons. Occupational safety and health administrative laws and various regulations forced companies to conform to standards of workplace safety or face serious penalties. And most states passed a minimum subsistence wage. And Americans are crap socialists, forever lighting out for the territory in the spirit of rugged individualism you hear so much about on truck commercials. Many of the biggest American corporations, such as Amazon, have become world-class union busters. As Cesar Chavez himself pointed out repeatedly, large-scale immigration makes it all but impossible to keep a union together. Desperate people don't make the terrible journey to this country to go on strike. They do it so they can send money to their impoverished families as quickly as possible. But the real reason union membership is so low in this country is globalization. What that word means for Americans is that corporations found the ultimate means of union busting. They sent the jobs away. Good jobs that usually paid well in a union shop that once upon a time allowed one parent to support a family. They sent them to China and India and Mexico and Bangladesh, places where people will work for far less money and with far fewer demands. All of this means that we have two or more generations of Americans who have no idea how labor politics work and who believe that hashtag boycotts are as effective as the real thing. In 2018, two black men were arrested at a Philadelphia Starbucks on suspicion of trespassing, which ignited one of the many attempts to hashtag boycott Starbucks that have taken place over the years. It may have been the most successful of these efforts in that it spurred the company to relax its policy regarding the use of the cafes and using their cafes and bathrooms without buying anything. But the boycotters had no real power because nobody stopped buying Starbucks, which was apparently just a bridge too far. Hashtag boycott the place, yes. Ankle it up to the block to Pete's? Come on. Starbucks eventually helped the boycotters out by staging a kind of self-boycott, closing thousands of stores for an afternoon of anti-bias training, and thereby contributing a few hours of lost sales to the cause. Hashtag boycott Chick-fil-A, initiated in reaction to the owner's disapproval of gay marriage, began more than a decade ago, during which time the company has only grown. There are principles, and there is the spicy chicken sandwich, and one of them has got to give. Now there's a counterinsurgency of Chick-fil-A, hashtag boycotters. It has something to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion equals bad. So conservatives and liberals can find common ground in cramming their mouths full of deep-fried chicken while hashtag boycotting the company that makes it. The same is true about hashtag boycott Gillette and hashtag boycott Nike. These hashtag boycotts weren't about labor disputes. They were about commercials and the perception that American corporations were in the pocket of woke, quote, leadership. They were puny and powerless, and they were the only kind of boycott that millions of young people have taken part in. This is why the sweeping success of the boycotts of Bud Light and Target this spring has left many leftists confused and angry and hurt. Activists on the right deployed the old union tactic for frivolous causes, and it worked. Bud Light lost a quarter of its sales. Target lost more than $13 billion in market cap. all of us associate boycotts with some of the greatest fights of the past century, the Montgomery bus boycott, or the United Farm Workers boycotts and strikes. But a boycott has no inherent moral position. It's just a strategy. The seeds of both recent boycotts were similar and ultimately had to do with the growing visibility of transgender people in mainstream culture. Bud Light engaged Dylan Mulvaney, a trans influencer, to make a 50-second promotional video released only on her Instagram account. Target's annual display of Pride merchandise include a kind of women's swimsuit that could disguise a penis. The display also had children's clothes, which rang alarm bells for many conservatives. The boycotts themselves weren't in any larger sense meaningful. Some men started drinking different brands of beer. So what? Some Target shoppers started going to Walmart. So what? You can buy whatever you want, and you can not buy whatever you want. As every episode of Mad Men proved, people have a deep and powerful association with the brands they like, associations that have much more to do with advertising than with the relative merit of the products. Forget Don Draper. Listen to Mick Jagger. He can't be a man because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. It's a big country, and people think and feel all kind of things. What is meaningful are the threats of violence that quickly accompany the boycotts. On May 24th, Target announced that it would be removing some of the Pride items because of threats impacting our team members' sense of safety and well-being while at work. It was a cautiously worded statement, and some couldn't help but wonder whether Target was just weaseling a way to appease boycotters. Then in mid-June, Target stores in five states had to be evacuated because of bomb threats sent to local media outlets, many of which contacted the police. It seemed at first that this was the realization of the chain's dark intimations about the far right. The truth was more complicated. A Vermont police chief said the threats included emails accusing Target of betraying the LGBTQ community. In Louisiana, a local news station reported on the email it received, which called the company pathetic cowards who bowed to the wishes of the far-right extremists. You could tell how utterly confusing all this is to the left by the response of the liberal press. A Washington Post opinion piece revealed that the writer was game for a fight, but deeply confused about the terms of engagement. The free market is telling right-wingers something they refuse to hear. Transgender people exist and they buy stuff. But Target's huge loss of market cap wasn't the result of transgender people boycotting. It was the result of anti-transgender people boycotting. And the literal definition of the free market is the ability of consumers to shop wherever they want. The writer was on the right side of history, but the wrong side of the wealth of nations. There was also a counterfactual attempt to posit the precipitous decline in Target's stock was unrelated to the boycotts. CNN Business published an article called "Here's the Real Reason Target's Stock is Dropping," which located a mix of factors to explain the sudden development, including broader changes in the U.S. economy, the possibility of a recession, and Target's overexposure to discretionary merchandise. Hey, Smitty, short Target for me. I think on Wednesday, shoppers are going to freak out about the broader changes to the U.S. economy. The New Republic published an article called "The Right's War on Brands is Stupid and Terrifying," which bore the characteristic traits of the form. The writer's outrage over the transphobic response forced him to present the boycotts as a heartless attack and defenseless corporate America. Cross the piss, babies, and your stock price will tank, your quarterly earnings will collapse, and your executives will be fired. I haven't encountered rhetoric like this since the Reagan administration. If the sign of the apocalypse is the New Republic fretting about the quarterly earnings and executive job security of a company like Anheuser-Busch, it's time to get in the bunker. Anheuser-Busch's CEO earns about $12 million a year, and its warehouse workers, at least in Southern California, where I live, and which is one of the most expensive regions in the country, start at $18 an hour. temp warehouse workers must be able to work with minimal supervision and in cold temperatures and to perform the physical requirements of the job. Those physical requirements include being able to spend entire shifts loading and unloading trucks in a refrigerated warehouse. The benefits package includes some inspirational language and the promise of free beer. These workers should not earn $18 an hour while their CEO, sitting in ergonomic comfort and temperature-controlled ease, earns $5,700 an hour. As for Target, where to start? Its stores are full of fast fashion, well known to be a human rights and environmental disaster. The differential between its CEO pay and his workers' pay is similarly shameful. The confusion about these boycotts reveals something much larger than an infirm grasp of how strategy works, and larger even than the pain and fear they produce in transgender people and their allies. It's part of something that is so pervasive among Americans, and especially young Americans, that one hardly notices it anymore. The feeling of being powerless against huge forces that they understand to exist far beyond their control, including the questionable or outright evil action of giant corporations. Last year, The Nation ran an article entitled, "Don't Boycott Amazon. They're too big to be hurt by individual consumer choice. Instead, hit them where it really hurts." When I first read it, I thought the piece was very funny. But in the months since, I found it poignant. The writer offers a complicated strategy. Don't just feel bad when you buy from Amazon. Make it count by kicking in twice as much to the Amazon labor union, and let Amazon know why. The strategy also involves buying Amazon stock. Jesus wept. You could say that this writer would be well served by brushing up on the fundamentals of microeconomics and the institutes of logic, but it was the personal example of her sense of powerlessness against the machine that got my attention. She says she's been avoiding shopping on Amazon, but then she slipped. Her cat's veterinarian had recommended a certain product and had sent her an Amazon link to it, which the writer used to buy it. Immediately, I felt the anger and guilt that comes with trying to be a person of conscience in a culture of pathological convenience, and I felt foolish for imagining that ethical consumerism can do anything other than temporarily assuage those feelings. That's the sign of a demoralized person, one who feels herself to have no agency at all. We haven't left these young people much. Many of them are so terrified about global warming that they believe that bringing a child into this world would be wrong. The retreat from religion has perhaps unburdened many of them from unfounded claims, but what has replaced it? What provides a community of shared belief, social outreach, the sense of living for some larger purpose? Nothing. What is the reliable path into the middle class, one that requires only a willingness to work hard? It's gone. Corporate America sent it away. The Bud Light and Target boycotts have been the most successful anti-consumer boycotts in a quarter century. They made two large companies sustain serious material losses. That isn't cause for more NUI or alienation. It's a beacon. It can be done, and it should be done. I said that one of the reasons that union membership had dried up is that OSHA had made workplaces safer. But as this article was closing, a 16-year-old boy was killed while working at the Marjack Poultry Processing Plant in rural Mississippi. According to the New York Times, Duvan Thomas Perez died after becoming ensnared in a machine he was cleaning. His family posted an obituary describing him as having been a student at N.R. Berger Middle School, the mission of which is to educate all students to become productive citizens of a dynamic global community. On Saturday, he will be buried. The obituary noted the date of the visitation and that a massive Christian burial will follow at 11:30 a.m. at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live, and whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. My mother knew Cesar Chavez, which was one of the reasons she was so committed to his cause. And now, a literal lifetime later, a Central American boy has been killed on a factory floor, and his education, his future, his life ended in what must surely have been an event of overwhelming terror and pain, dying in the same pitiless place where chickens are killed. And do you know what the company had to say about his death? It was, of course, a tragedy, but it wasn't the company's fault. It appears at this point in the investigation that this individual's age and identity were misrepresented on the paperwork. Do you know what I say to that? Strike. Boycott. Shut it down. Next is an edition of Books Briefing, The Book Behind Oppenheimer by Gal Beckerman. I've always been curious about what it feels like for an author to see their work translated into another medium. The question seems particularly interesting with a film like Oppenheimer, the biopic directed by Christopher Nolan that opened in theaters this week. It tells the life story of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the man known as the father of the atomic bomb, and based on a mammoth Pulitzer Prize-winning 2005 biography that took 25 years to research and write, American Prometheus, by Kai Bird and Warren J. Sherwin, is more than 700 pages long. At first glance, it's difficult to imagine how a book this granular about a subject this complex became a movie. Sadly, Sherwin passed away 2 years ago, but Bird was able to have the uncanny experience of, quote, meeting Oppenheimer while visiting the set of Nolan's film. I talked with him about this encounter and about the book's path to Hollywood. Bird and I spoke over the phone a day before the film's release. This interview has been condensed and edited for clarity. Gal Beckerman, how are you feeling? Kai Bird, well, my head is spinning a little bit. It's very weird. This book came out 18 years ago. Where was everyone then? Beckerman, well, you did win the Pulitzer Prize. You can't say that it was ignored. Bird, that's true. I can't complain. But you know, it got on the paperback bestseller list last week. It never made it on the bestseller list back then. Beckerman, it took a long time for it to be picked up and adapted. Bird, well, the book was optioned, but you know, years went by and nothing happened. So we were very lucky when I suddenly got a phone call in September of 2021, and I was told that Christopher Nolan wants to speak to me. I didn't realize it then, but looking back at all his other work, he's really the perfect director for this book. He's always been interested in time and space and memory, science and science fiction. So it makes perfect sense that he could be attracted to a book about a guy who was a quantum physicist. Beckerman, so the shift to film felt pretty seamless to you? Bird, the way Marty Sherwin and I both thought about the book, and this would be true of any potential film as well, that it might be an interesting story to follow the making of the atomic bomb, but that if that's all there was, we wouldn't be spending all these years, 25 years, on it. What gives the story its arc is both the triumph of Oppenheimer's achievement in Los Alamos, but then the tragedy of what happens to him 9 years later, when he's brought down from being America's most famous scientist to becoming a non-entity, humiliated on the front pages of the New York Times. His loyalty to the country is questioned. That's what makes the story really interesting. And so, when I first had a meeting with Nolan, he was not sharing the script with me at that point. He said he works confidentially, although he'd done a whole draft already. He works very fast. I told him I thought it was important to focus on the trial, and I think he was relieved to hear me say that, because when he showed me the screenplay a few months later, it really is a lot about the trial. Beckerman, were there aspects of the book that you thought would be particularly difficult to communicate in film without the benefit of hundreds and hundreds of pages? Bird, the quantum physics. This is also a struggle in the book because it's so complex, but actually Nolan really attempts to explain quantum or give you a sense of the music of it. He develops a good analogy in the film. He has Oppenheimer walking through an art gallery in the 1920s when he's studying quantum, and he's looking at cubist pictures done by Picasso, and he's staring at them and he's seeing the quantum in Picasso's images. That's not specifically in the book, But you know, Oppenheimer's mother was a painter and an art collector. She bought early Van Goghs and several Picassos, so it's entirely appropriate. Beckerman, did you learn anything about filmmaking through this process? Bird, I saw the film for the fourth time last night, and each time I see it, I see layers that I didn't see on the first occasion. I hear some of the dialogue that I missed on previous occasions, because it is very fast-paced. Nolan is really quite interesting as a filmmaker, I think, precisely because he's not trying to bring you along. He's not trying to make sure you understand everything. He's leaving little clues throughout the visual experience that he doesn't explain. So, for example, if you know who the physicist Richard Feynman is, he is portrayed in the film, but he's never identified. But on several occasions, you see this young man banging furiously on a bongo, and that's Feynman. Beckerman, and if you know, you know. Bird, exactly. He wants people to leave the theater with questions. Oh, who was that? And questions about, you know, McCarthyism, living with the bomb, and why did that happen to Oppenheimer? Was it just or unjust? He's not giving you the answers, and he does that with the whole very weighty issue of the decision to actually use the bomb, which is still controversial history. Beckerman, I know that you went to visit the set while they were filming. I'm curious if you could tell me a little bit more about what that experience was like, just the uncanniness of it, and you know, meeting Cillian Murphy, who played Oppenheimer. Bird, it was very bizarre. When I met Cillian, he was being introduced to me after shooting a scene, and I shouted out, "Dr. Oppenheimer, Dr. Oppenheimer, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I've been waiting all these years." And then we had a 5-minute conversation, and I told him I thought it was interesting how he had captured Oppie's voice. Oppenheimer's voice was always very soft-spoken. It's the kind of voice that makes you want to lean forward to make sure you've caught every word, and each word is pronounced very meticulously, and he speaks in whole paragraphs. Cillian's response was, "Oh, well, I'm glad you think so. But, you know, we try not to imitate the voice. We try to simply capture the spirit of it." Beckerman, "Well, that seems a pretty apt description of adaptation when it works. Well, as it sounds like it did in this case." Bird, "I just think I'm a lucky, lucky author." We have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.